working as our web helpers, and we really appreciate that. Another thing I just wanted to mention that I thought was really cool, there's something called the Community Singing. It's an event, I think it's once a month, and this month it will be April 20th at the Matchwood Brewery Company outside, where they have that big fire pit, and someone leads the community in song. So if you like to sing, come on down and join the community and sing.
And sing. Got a lot of singing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, Susie.
Okay. Well, we have, again, Sally Lowry and Bobby Franklin. You're both very involved in CAL, which is the Community Assistance League. We call it CAL for short. We've known that for a long time. It has a lot of influence and support in our community that really makes a difference. And so, Sally, I hear you're the historian about Community Assistance League. Why don't you give us a little picture about how it started? We know we're coming up to the 40-year anniversary, but what was the reason and how has that streamed through up to this point, 40 years later?
Well, yes, 40 years ago, there were 16 women who had children in elementary school, but primarily in middle school and high school. And they were sitting around, first of all, bored with their lives because there wasn't much to do in Sandpoint at that time, and also very concerned about our education system. And so they started, at that time, the Community Assistance League. And assistance, community and assistance are the two main words. And the first thing that they did, which is still going on today, is help pass the first school levy. And they were really involved with that. Amazingly to me, two of the women who started that 40 years ago are still active in CAL, Pat Lewis and Sally Transu. And many of the things that continued on with their start, for example, one of the first big things that they got involved with was starting the music festival. And they were instrumental in cleaning the fields and giving out programs and doing everything that they could for that. They started, because of their education, what they call the after-school academy, where they were teaching the kids art and music because they were very concerned about the arts, lack of art teaching in this community. And then they just continued on. And so, of course, that all involved fundraising. So they raised the money to do whatever they were doing to assist in other things. They were very involved with the Special Olympics when it came to town, with the volleyball tournament when it came. More recently, when ABC came to town and did the Extreme Home Makeover, they provided all the food for the crews, arranged for all of that. And to this day, education is still one of their main interests, and they just keep on giving. Interestingly, I found the first woman who was given a scholarship from Cal, and that was in 1987. And she's still very active in this community and so appreciative of what we've done. So Cal, I think, has influenced people in so many ways that we're not even aware of.
I think in the beginning you also had a yearly big, huge, gigantic garage sale kind of thing, and now you have a storefront.
Right. Well, the that first one started in, let's see, I've got the date down here, in 1982. And it was at the where the automobile repair center is now. And they did that for 2 years. And then they moved to the community center. And every year they would gather up all this merchandise, do one huge day sale. And then they had all this merchandise left over to get rid of. But it was the first way that they really learned to gather money and make something that was really more than just bake sales or raffles, which, you know, most people do. And then they finally, in November 15th, 2010, opened their first Bazaar Bazaar on the Kootenai Cutoff Road. And we had that for 8 years. It was, I mean, we took it from nothing and really did a lot with it and realized that this was a huge opportunity to make money for this community. And so then we moved to our present location 8 years later, and that's where we still are.
And you're over there on Church Street. And the thing that's amazing when I go in there, because I like to shop there, is there's so many helpers in the back working, and it's everything's so beautifully put together. In fact, I got this sweater there.
Oh, good.
And everyone who works there is a volunteer, is my understanding.
That's right. We, even the bookkeepers, the store managers, we pay no one for anything. Every single thing is a volunteer.
And so after the rent and utilities, everything goes back to the community.
Right. Exactly.
And so you have some really cool stuff in there.
We do.
Yeah. Where does that come from?
Donations from the community. And we have people who will go out if there's a garage sale, and they will go out after the garage sale is closed down and the people are still left with stuff and collect it and bring it. Or people will call and say, you know, somebody, we have to move and we have all this extra things. Would you like it? And we'll go out and gather it. But it's very important to us for the word upscale. We do not put anything in the store that we do not think is in good shape. We have people who wash clothes. We have people who, of course, everything is ironed before we put it on the floor. We have people who sew buttons on.
It's a great shopping experience there. You have housewares and linens.
Right.
A small children's section upstairs and a men's section and beautiful clothes and books, a lot of books. A
lot of books. And every Friday, books are on sale for half price.
There you go. Good place to donate when we're cleaning out and doing our Maria Kondo clean out, right?
Please.
Yeah. Did you mention the location where people can find that? Yeah.
Well, it's on the corner of Church and right off of Fifth. And it says Bazaar Bazaar in big letters. It's you'll find it.
Yeah, it's right next to the Pie Hut. Right next to the Pie Hut.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which is a great place to eat as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I know you do have active programs going on all the time as well, and a big one is coming up right now. It's your annual grant cycle.
Grants so and scholarships.
Tell us about that.
Okay, why don't you talk about grants?
Okay, I'll talk about grants. The season opened the 1st of March this year, and it will close on Saturday, the 30th. Every application has to be in by 4 o'clock. So if you're emailing an application or you're sending it, make sure it gets postmarked. I gather all of those applications and put them into a notebook and copy off the notebook. And then I have a committee of 12 people who will go through those notebooks and they'll decide where our money's going to go. So it's a big deal. April 4th will be the day that the committee will be given the notebooks, and April 25th will be the day that they make the decision. And we call that the decision meeting. That's where we give out all of our money that's been allocated for grants.
And how much is that? How much do you typically allocate? Oh, you don't know.
Last year, we had $112,500 that went into grants that went out into the community.
Wow. How many grants?
Wasn't also part of that scholarship money?
No.
Strictly grants.
That was strictly grants. Wow. Scholarships was separate from that.
And how many grants did that make?
That made 42 grants last year.
So tell us the nature of endeavors that you like to support with the grants.
Well, as Sally mentioned, one of the reasons Community Assistance League was formed was educational support. And so over 50%, or just right around 50%, of what we gave out last year was things that supported education. A literacy program where children were provided books that they wanted to read over the summer so they didn't have the summer slide where they lose progress. We did some classroom improvements in a couple of the schools. The big thing right now is everybody's trying to make a, they call them maker spaces. They're for their STEM program, which is science, technology, engineering, art, and math. And so that program, they collect all of the associated supplies from the classrooms, and they put it in one big room, and then the students cycle through there, and they have enhanced learning in these areas, which is so critical right now, because that's where we're going. That's where the jobs are going to be. And then we do community improvements. We do things like support the food bank and the senior Sandpoint seniors who give out the Meals on Wheels. And we do environmental support for things like the Pondere Waterkeeper. And so we have a lot of good places to put money. It's always hard to know where you're going to put it. But these people, these 12 people, are the ones that make that decision, not me. I'm just the person that puts everything together for them, and then they take that and run with it.
One of the things that came to mind is, it sounds like it's somewhat focused on children, so collaborative organizations that are collaborating possibly to do work with children. I think I mentioned working with the high school students on a project or something like that would be possibly in that grant group.
It would. Yes. We, in fact, do work with Sandpoint High School and help to support the finance fair every year. And one of the things that happened 2 years ago, they came to our committee and asked us to represent giving back to the community. And they have actually got a table that's set up for them to learn to give charitably back into the community. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So, Bobby Franklin, how would someone find out? We have a few days left before the end. That's Saturday at 4 o'clock. Grants have to be in or postmarked. What? How does someone find out more or get a grant if they're listening and are interested?
We do have a web page for those who have access to a computer, and that's calsandpoint.org. And if you scroll down once you get into the site, at the bottom right, there's a place where you can open up a grant application and fill it out and send it on to me at calsandpointgrants@gmail.com.
Is there a phone number if someone wanted to call and find out more? Is it pretty self-explanatory?
It's pretty self-explanatory, mm-hmm. but certainly I would prefer they email me at that address, calsandpointgrants@gmail.com. And then in the event you don't have access or you don't feel like using the computer, Bizarre Bazaar has applications, as does East and West Bonner County Libraries, Clark Fork Library, Old Town Library, the Sandpoint Chamber of Commerce.
Lots of places. And by the way, Bazaar Bazaar is on 502 Church Street.
502 Church. It's at the corner of Church and Fifth.
Exactly.
Yep.
Next to the Pie Hut.
And so you're encouraging any groups out there that may have projects that would be applicable to get an application in by Saturday?
Sure. And, you know, if you go online and you read the application, the first two pages tell you what the criteria are that need to be fulfilled in order to be considered. So you can kind of see if your organization fits into that.
Yeah. Great. Now, you mentioned scholarships. Do you do scholarships as a separate program?
Yes, we do, because, again, it's a huge program. Last year, we gave out a total of 29 scholarships. Working with Sandpoint High School, they have Gerald A. Meyer has said that Cal gives out is always among the top three in giving out scholarship dollars to the community. And we offer it to anybody who is currently a senior, including homeschool students can apply for it. We do Priest River, Clark Fork, the alternative school. We then also offer scholarships to those who have been out of school for at least a year, have had to delay their education or want to go back to school. We also offer it to those who got scholarships last year from Cal and want to continue on. And so we offer a wide variety of opportunities for students to get money in this community. And it's amazing to me what a wonderful job Gerald Lindmeyer has done, because she has developed a common application form that everyone who wants to give out money can use the same form for the students, and you get that online. Well, what that means is the student doesn't have to get a different application from every organization, and actually there's 62 of them offering scholarships this year at Sandpoint High. So it's a huge job, and I think this figure is fascinating. If I can find it here. Last year, it was in the Sandpoint High School, there were over 980 applications submitted by 80 students. So you can just imagine, I mean, we are expecting to get about 100 applications for scholarships this year.
And how big do the scholarships tend to be? And there's probably a range, I imagine.
Range from $800 to $1,500.
No, not insignificant at all.
Yeah, that's big. Yeah.
We really don't want to give anything that isn't supportive to their financial needs.
Mm-hmm. At $800, that's about what books cost for that first year.
So, you know, it could be wonderful to help somebody with that.
Mm-hmm. And what is the criteria? Is it academic achievement, or is it very
important academic achievement and financial need? Also, goals. What are their goals, and what do they want to achieve? What have they done in school in addition to their academics? Have they helped the community? Have they been involved in sports or in liberal arts or in whatever other kind of things? How have they worked? Have they saved money? I think this is interesting too. And I know this is Sandpoint High. I assume all the schools do this. In their English class, they write their 2-page summary of what their goals are and what they want to do. And that becomes an English assignment, but then they use that for their scholarships.
So that could get corrected and become a perfect document for
them
to share
to
get scholarships.
Uh-huh.
So we only have a few minutes left here, but so someone's listening. They're inspired by all the cool things you're doing. How did they get involved with Cal?
Well, all you have to do is come to a meeting. I mean, we now have 259 members in Cal. We prefer that they all give time to Bazaar Bazaar, because that's how we get our money in order to go back and support all of these other activities. In addition to actually scholarships and grants, we also give money out during the year. We do things like the Kinderhaven tree. Last year for the Kinderhaven Festival of Trees, our tree got $10,100, I think. And, you know, we do all the work to do a tree. Or we are having our luncheon, which is going to be Kentucky Derby Day luncheon in April. And with that, we will be giving the money to...
half goes to the tree.
And half goes to something, I'm not sure, but we do give to Daybreak and
that's
Senior Center and other kind of organizations during the year. So, mm-hmm.
And it looks like your spring luncheon you just mentioned is actually April 24th.
Right.
Is that open just to members? Or
just
anybody?
To members.
Just to members.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
But if you want to get interested and come to a general meeting, those are the third Wednesday of the month.
Right.
9:30 a.m. at the it's actually at the Columbia Bank Community
Theater. Yeah.
Right.
And you have a 40-year anniversary coming up. Do you have a big party planned?
We are planning a major, major party if it all comes through. Yes.
Okay.
And, you will be hearing a lot more about that.
We'll have you back on to talk about that. And really appreciate your coming on. Sally Lowry with scholarships, Bobby Franklin with grants, and all kinds of good stuff that our wonderful Community Assistance League is doing. We appreciate your coming here today, but also the work you're doing. So
and
thank you.
We're going to be taking on a new topic here in just a minute. We're going to be talking with Shannon Williamson from Lake Pondre Waterkeeper, but we're going to take a little musical break. It's about 3.5 minutes, and this is one of the bands that are going to be playing the festival at Sandpoint this year. It's Cool and the Gang. That was just announced this week that they're going to be playing. This is a classic band. It's going to really be a great one for the festival. This song is called Celebration. We'll be back in just a minute, so stay with us. And that was Cool and the Gang. And they are going to be playing the festival at Sandpoint this summer in August. I don't have that date exactly, but it's at, I think it's the second week of August they're playing. And it's going to be great to see them live and in person. And we have a new guest in the studio here, Susie.
We have Shannon Williamson. She's the executive director of the Lake Pendere Waterkeeper. Good morning, Shannon.
Good morning.
It's always nice to have you here. And we just want to also give a shout out to Lake Pendere Waterkeeper as a valued underwriter here at KRFY. And you have a lot to share with us today. So what is going on that is... I know the last time you were here, not too long ago, we were talking about the railroad bridges, the second bridge with BNSF, and the due dates and public comment period. So where are we at with that?
Yeah, I'd love to give you a quick update on that. So the public comment period just ended this Monday, and there were two public hearings that took place on March 13th, one in the morning and one in the evening. And overall, we felt that there was pretty good attendance at those public hearings. And one thing that was really notable is that overwhelmingly, the public was asking for more thorough environmental review of the project through an environmental impact statement, which was encouraging to hear. And through the written process, through regulations.gov, that's how people could submit public comments in writing. And you could follow along in real time about how many comments had been submitted, and you could actually review them online. There was a little bit of a delay as of Monday because people were rushing to get their comments in. But the last time I looked, I did a quick tally to see how many people were in favor of expanded environmental review versus those that felt that the environmental assessment was sufficient. And at my last count, 2,128 folks were asking for an EIS versus 69 that were satisfied with the process. So I think our community has spoken loud and clear that we deserve really thorough environmental review of this project. So it's out of our hands now. It's in the hands of the Coast Guard. They have to respond to all of these comments, and so that's going to take some time, and they couldn't give us a definitive answer on how long that was going to take. But now we're just kind of waiting to see what decision they make.
So what would Waterkeeper like to see happen at this point?
Well, we want the Coast Guard to do the right thing. And the right thing would be to require a full environmental impact statement. That would be the next step. And so that's one of their options. Their other option is to conclude that there are no significant impacts, which we think would be just a tragic mistake.
One of the things I think about when we talk about railroads and how Sandpoint is kind of a funnel for a lot of tracks coming from the north, the west, and the east. And so it is different than some places. It's all important to have safe railroad policies and tracks and environmental protection. But this is especially sensitive. Is that what you
see? Well, the lake,
too?
Yeah, the lake is a, you know, it's a state treasure. I think it's a national treasure. And we have, you know, 30 miles of track going along its shoreline and over the lake. And we carry, you know, these trains are carrying a variety of hazardous materials that, in the event of a spill or a derailment, you know, we're just not prepared. We have a geographic response plan that specifically addresses spills of oil, but that's it. So we're not prepared to really protect our water from any other type of hazardous material. And the document that was produced, the environmental assessment, just had so many deficiencies all over the board, especially in terms of spill risk. And they really just need to go back to the drawing board and do a much thorough analysis so that we really understand what we're facing. We just don't, and that's not fair.
Are there mitigating ways for the railroad to make it safer, to mitigate potential hazard spills?
I think there's lots of mitigation that could be studied and put into place, and the environmental assessment just, you know, really fell short in that area as well. And an EIS would really provide the framework to study mitigation and figure out ways that we can best protect our water and our community.
And what is Burlington Northern Santa Fe's posture on this?
They want to start building it right now.
They want to get going this building season?
As soon as possible, as far as I understand. Yeah. I mean, it's a 3 to 5 year construction project. So construction would be year round. It's going to have, I think, personally, it's going to have a devastating impact on our economy, which was not even looked at remotely in the environmental assessment and desperately needs to. It's a huge project. Mm-hmm. And it deserves, you know, very thorough analysis. So we're cautiously optimistic, I guess would be the appropriate word to use, that the Coast Guard will recognize that there are going to be significant impacts that need to be studied. And I haven't been able to read every sentence of every comment that was submitted. There's over 2,000 of them, but I have spent a lot of time reviewing them. And it's not people just chiming in saying, you know, I don't want this project. People have been extremely articulate about what their concerns are and what their suggestions are and what they think should be studied. And I think it's really valuable. So I'm hopeful that the Coast Guard will heed the community's desires in this respect and perform the analysis.
Would the analysis be something that's likely to stop construction of the bridge?
That's really difficult to say. I mean, you can't really understand what's going to come out of that analysis until it's done. And what an EIS will do is evaluate all of the risks and potential benefits of the project and determine what mitigating factors can be put into place. The only way I could see that this project wouldn't be permitted is if there are significant risks that are revealed that cannot be mitigated for. That's the only scenario that I would imagine would happen. I can't tell you, you know, the chances of that happening. We just want the study to be done.
Mm-hmm. And in these public comments, obviously putting in the second bridge allows the increased train traffic. And that's part of the picture. And that doubles maybe the potential.
Well, it's funny because there were no numerical projections of increased train volumes. And we thought, you know, how can you perform any of these analyses and come to these conclusions that they did in this environmental assessment saying, oh, there's no risk of this, there's no risk of that. You know, we just don't know how many trains are going to come through, so we can't make any decisions around this. And I think that's laughable. I mean, who would build a $100 million project and have zero clue as to how many trains might be coming through here in the future? I mean, there's no way. That's reality, in my opinion. So that was just one of our many points that we discussed in our comments that we submitted. But it's absolutely critical that projections of rail volumes in the future are included in these analyses. You cannot come to any conclusions without that information.
So now the Coast Guard is weighing all mm-hmm. the feedback.
Yes.
We don't know when they might take their next action, which will be some sort of ruling on whether or not to go for a more thorough mm-hmm. environmental analysis. What can citizens do in this interim period here? Is there a role for citizen input still?
At this point in time, I think people just need to stay vigilant. I mean, it's our job to inform the community, you know, when this decision comes out. But as for, you know, any additional public comment, that opportunity is over, unfortunately. There was a 45-day comment period. And I think that, you know, I was really pleased to see the level of public involvement in our community. And it just kind of speaks to how important the potential ramifications of this project are. It's not just one bridge, it's three. So that's important to note.
And Chris, when you ask what regular citizens can do now during this interim period, on the website, Lake Ponderé Waterkeeper, it says you can donate, you can volunteer with us, you can become a member.
Yes, thank you for pointing all that out.
Beautiful website. And it's not just those points. There's a lot of information on it about, and probably updates on where we're at or where this project is at.
Yeah, we try to keep you know, as up-to-date information as possible on our website. And again, once we have any idea about which direction the Coast Guard is deciding to go, we will certainly be sharing that information with the community. You know, if they make the right decision and decide to do an EIS, there's going to be another public scoping period, and it's going to be absolutely critical for everybody to weigh in again. And so, you know, we'll be helping to guide people through that process if that's where we end up.
Mm-hmm. you have a lot of other things going on and other things you wanted to talk about today.
I did want to mention one thing. We did invite Burlington Northern Santa Fe to come in and talk as well. We've extended that invitation a couple times, and they just haven't taken us up on it. So we might in the future.
I think that's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be great to hear from some of the company officials directly.
You also wanted to talk about stormwater runoff and your monitoring program.
Yeah, it's the season for stormwater. You know, we've been really lucky to have this beautiful weather over the last week or so, and the snow is melting fast. And I'm sure everyone's seen, you know, it's mud season, but you're seeing a ton of water go down our drains as well. And there's been one particular monitoring effort we've been doing for the last couple of years that I wanted to bring people's attention to. And that's stormwater that's originating and running off what we call the Joslyn property. And so the Joslyn property is located on North Boyer, kind of kitty corner to Super One. And it's, if you're driving by it, it kind of looks like a vacant lot with a bunch of pipes sticking out of it. And it was the location of a former wood treatment facility that used a lot of creosote. And so all of the sediments on that property are very badly contaminated with chemicals originating from creosote. And so over the past several years, the Department of Environmental Quality has been monitoring the groundwater or overseeing the monitoring effort of groundwater, contaminated groundwater on the property in an effort to try to contain that contaminated groundwater on to that space. And so a couple years ago, we kind of mapped where the stormwater that runs off that property drains to. And it drains to an outfall right near the Chamber of Commerce, behind the Chamber of Commerce, that pokes out into Sand Creek. And so we started collecting samples there and noticed something that was disturbing, which was detectable levels of a chemical called pentachlorophenol, or PCP for short. And that's one of the quote-unquote chemicals of concern that has been monitored for in groundwater. And so we knew it was in groundwater, but it became readily apparent to us that it was also in contaminated surface water that is draining into Sand Creek. And this particular chemical is a probable carcinogen. It's also linked with renal and neurological impacts. And so we became really concerned. And so over time, as we've been monitoring, and especially over the last couple of months, particularly in January, the concentration of PCP really spiked to the level where it exceeded chronic and acute water quality standards for aquatic life in our waterways. So that's a problem. And it's a serious problem. And we've brought this to the attention of the Department of Environmental Quality and have shared all of our data that we've collected over the last couple of years in an effort to get them to recognize that the problem that they're trying to deal with in terms of keeping the company accountable is not contained to groundwater, because that project does not recognize any surface water contamination. And we're showing them and providing them with evidence that there is indeed surface water contamination and that this remediation project needs to include this component. So that's been challenging for us. One, because the department typically does not recognize third-party data without it reaching a certain quality level. And so we're in the process of developing a quality assurance project plan, or QAP, which we also use for monitoring surface water of the lake and river, so that they will recognize the data that we're providing to them. This is very expensive to do this test. It's about, I think it's $375 or so per test for this particular chemical. And so it's you know, important that we continue to monitor, but we don't want to be throwing money out the window either if they're not going to recognize the information. So once we establish this QAPP, our costs are going to triple, because then we need to collect what's called a duplicate sample and also a blank sample to test for contamination within our sample protocol. So that's really daunting. And so we want to make people aware of this, that this contamination has been going on for years and it's getting worse. And we have not at this point been able to convince the department to voluntarily include surface water remediation in their programming. We are working on it. We will continue to work on it. And part of our strategy is collecting data under this quality assurance project plan as they've required of us. But we just wanted people to be aware that this situation is going on. And if people are concerned or they want to learn more, we really encourage them to reach out to us and we can share more details of the project. But if anybody out there is concerned that, you know, a probable carcinogen is pouring into Sand Creek where, you know, you may recreate or your pets may recreate in the summertime, please let us know because we need your voice heard. Because we're one voice with the department right now. We need other voices.
So how do we give it to this pollutant?
Well, there's various different strategies that the company has tried so far to contain contaminated groundwater to the site. That's all they're required to do. Keep it on the site. They have not been successful. And so they looked at what's called natural attenuation, which means do nothing. That didn't work. Surprise, surprise. They have most recently are testing out a chemical oxidant, which they inject into these wells, which is supposed to oxidize the chemicals. But as we know, soils have organic material, and so that's going to be oxidized first. And so we've been getting their monitoring reports through the public records process, and we're not sure if that process has been successful yet, because they're a little bit behind in their quarterly monitoring or what the availability of those reports are to us. But I believe the first one that we were able to look at didn't look like it was successful. And so every time a strategy fails, they're required to try something new, but they're allowed to monitor for a year before they have to try. If they can show that they're failing for a year, and then they're like, okay, fine, I'm going to try something else. What's logical and what should be done is that the site should be excavated and the contaminated soils should be hauled away and incinerated, and that clean soils should be brought in. That's what should be done. They are not required to do that.
So is that enormously expensive?
It's very expensive, yeah. Yes. And so although I feel like the company's throwing away tons of money by doing bench testing or laboratory testing and then field testing of strategies that they know aren't going to work, and having to monitor. And those monitoring costs are quite expensive as well. I think in the end of the day, it would probably be more financially responsible to just do it. But we're not in a position to make them do it. The department isn't in a position to make them do it, unfortunately. It's a kind of complex court decision that decided what can and cannot be done in this case. So that's what we'd love to see done. But we need to keep producing the data that's demonstrating that what they are doing is not working. And more importantly, recognizing that this is not just a problem that's contained to groundwater. It's a problem that is reaching the surface and going into our public waterways, which is incredibly problematic.
Mm-hmm. There's still a pole yard right adjacent to that site.
There is.
Are they treating poles there still?
Not to my understanding. Mm-hmm. There was some residual there. That site used to be polluted as well. But in that case, they did dig up the contaminated soils. So I just, it's hard for me to wrap my head around sometimes. Like when you see a logical solution, I know a lot of it has to do with money, but you know, you could just fix it and move on. You know, that's a valuable piece of property too for the city that's totally useless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's what it seems to me. I drive by that site every day going to work, and it seems like, wow, there's a lot of potential there, but yeah, it can't be realized in its current state.
Right. And mm-hmm. So another point I'd like to bring up is that no one else is doing any stormwater monitoring in our area because our population is below the threshold that requires any kind of stormwater permitting, which is 10,000 for a municipality. And so we're going to get there within the next 5 years, and we will be regulated, or the city of Sandpoint will be regulated. So we thought it would be a good idea to kind of get out ahead of this and start doing some monitoring. And we are going to be monitoring a couple more locations, two that drain to Sand Creek and one to the river, this spring, and just to see, you know, what types of contaminants are present. We had no idea when we started sampling the drainage behind the chamber that we were going to find, you know, a probable carcinogen. We have no idea what's going into our waterways from stormwater, and stormwater is a significant pollutant. So we're going to start that effort pretty soon here to capture all of this runoff that's happening right now with the snowmelt. And if anybody is interested out there in participating and volunteering, that would be great. And please get in touch with us. Or perhaps even more importantly right now, helping support us financially in this effort. It's expensive to do stormwater monitoring. We do seasonal water quality monitoring at 15 locations across the lake and river, and that's expensive too, but this is about six times more expensive because we have to throw a wide net. We don't know what to expect, and so we have to test for a lot of different things, and things like metals are extremely expensive to test for. So we're going to do it because nobody else is going to do it.
So in that vein, if somebody wants to donate or just get involved with mm-hmm. Waterkeeper, what do they do?
Well, you can stop by our office is one way. We're at the corner of First and Cedar at 100 Cedar Street. You can give us a call at 208-597-7188. You can always donate online at www.lpow.org. We have a donate button, I think, on every page. It's not hard to find. Or, yeah, just stop by and chat with us and learn more about what we're trying to accomplish for our waterways.
Mm-hmm. So anything else going on that you want to tell folks about? We still have a few minutes.
Let's see. Well, we are getting ready to kick off our eighth year of that seasonal water quality monitoring. If anybody is interested in learning more, we're going to have two informational kind of orientation sessions, one on April 2nd and one on April 17th. And I believe it's from 4:30 to 5:30. But if anyone's curious, they can confirm with Chantilly, our waterkeeper. But the orientation component, I believe, is from 4:30 to 5:30. And then for those that have already committed to being our citizen scientists, our trainings are going to happen immediately after the orientation. But this is the program where we have, you know, it's all volunteer driven. People go out in their watercraft from May to September once a month and help us collect water quality samples that we've produced really significant data set now that we've shared with the state, and some really good regulatory decisions have come out of that program. And we're super excited about it. Can't believe it's going to be our eighth year. And we just have like an amazing group of volunteers. I'm just so happy at the involvement in this program.
So you have this upcoming 2019 Citizen Science New Volunteer Orientation. It does start at 4 o'clock.
4:30, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. That may have changed. And that's April 2nd and 17th. And people can call 208-597-7188 to find out more. Go to the website. It's
yep.
a great website.
Yeah, we'll get, if the information's not on there already, it will be. You can also get on, sign up for our email list through our website, and then you'll get all of the notifications about this program and everything else that we're doing as well. It's a great way to stay informed.
Okay. Well, Shannon Williamson, Lake Ponderay Waterkeeper, thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for all the work that Lake Ponderay Waterkeeper is doing to protect this, as you say, treasure. Mm-hmm. It is true.
It's our pleasure.
Oh, the lake is an outstanding resource for us. Let's take care of it. I wanted to mention that tomorrow on the morning show, hosts Jack Peterson and Jim Healy are going to be interviewing Karen Wedemeyer from the Music Conservatory of Sandpoint. And they're going to be talking about their Music Without Borders and Summer Academy programs that the Music Conservatory puts on. Airtime is at 8 a.m. That's tomorrow, Thursday, on right here on 88.5 KRFY. And Susie, what do you have to say for
yourself? Well, I just want to give the first shout out that on April 18th at the library, East Bonner County Library, KRFY, in partnership with the Sandpoint Reader and the Bonner County Human Rights Task Force, will be hosting a public talk with nationally syndicated radio show host David Barsamian. He has a show called Alternative Radio that is broadcast all over the country and the world.
Including right here on KRFY.
Right here on KRFY on Monday nights. And he will be talking about why journalism matters. Topic that's of good one to talk about.
Yeah, journalism is in a interesting place right now. It's the old business models that used to support it are failing, and there's actually a far smaller number of journalists working today because of these upheavals in the business models for mm-hmm. newspapers and even television stations and radio stations as well. So that's going to be a great program.
Yep, it's going to be a good talk. It is part of the Earth Week offering at the Sandpoint Library. So, and the library is also co-sponsoring it with us. So you can put that on your calendar now, and we'll see you there then. And yeah. I just want to say it's really nice to have a scientist in the room, because we don't always get that. So it was fun listening to all that scientific stuff. Thanks, Shannon.
And with that, we're going to go out now. We're going to hear a song by another band that's going to be playing the festival at Sandpoint this summer, the Abbott Brothers. And this is Head Full of Doubt, Road Full of Promise. And remember, you'll be able to hear them at the festival live. So check out this song. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk with you next week.
Have a great day.